There's a culture war going on in this country. We can no longer remain silent on the issues that affect us all. Decisions we make now will determine our future. But how do we engage with the culture in a way that honors Jesus? How do we rise above the noise to know what is right and what is true? It's time to bring God back into the conversation. It's time to reconnect. Here's Carmen.
Welcome, friends. I'm Carmen LaBurge, and this is The Reconnect, where we're putting God in His place, back where He belongs, right in the middle of every conversation. So how do we do that? How do we enter into the conversations of the day as the ambassadors of Jesus Christ? How do we speak the mind of Christ on the matters of the day? Let's face it, people don't need just another piece of our mind. What they need is the very peace of the mind of Christ. So I think you're just the person to give it to them. We've got resources posted for you on our website at reconnectwithcarmen.com. You can go there and you can share today's show with someone new. You can also go to Facebook. We'd appreciate it if you would like us on Facebook. And let us know what you're thinking about on Twitter. I'm at Carmen LaBurge. Hey, you can also always text me during the show here in the studio. The number is 877-655-6755. Again, the text line here in the studio to let me know what you're thinking is 877-655-6755. All right, folks, so there's a lot of people across the country who think that the lead story today is about basketball, and so we're going to lead with that story. The University of North Carolina has won the NCAA Men's Basketball Championship, but apparently under a bit of a cloud. So here is the lead from USA Today's reporting on it, although you could pretty much pick your venom this morning in terms of the coverage of last night's game, because it was the officiating, according to USA Today, that generated as much buzz as the buckets. Monday night's national championship game, they say, was a 71-65 win for the Tar Heels, finished with an average of more than one foul for every two possessions. Just think about that for a second. One foul for every two possessions. I don't know about you. That is not a game I would have wanted to have watched. That's just no fun at all. Making matters worse, the article says, UNC and Gonzaga combined to miss 20 free throws in 52 attempts. So there you have it. There's my roundup of the NCAA Men's Basketball Championship game, which apparently was not played on a basketball, was played on a basketball court, but was also played in a football stadium. Is that right? I mean, that sounds kind of crazy, but that apparently is how that worked out. So as a person who played softball, that was my chosen sport all along, I could talk about foul balls. I can't really talk about foul calls. And foul balls are a little bit easier to recognize. Everybody kind of knows what they are. Everybody, there's a straight line, and if the ball falls on one side of that, it is fair, and if it falls on the outside of that, it is foul. So foul calls are apparently in basketball pretty much up to the referees. And I guess if you watch last night's, you watch the replays that where some of these fouls were called, you will, as a basketball fan, recognize that some of these fouls were, well, maybe not fouls at all. All right, so this led me to think about not only foul balls and foul calls, but foul language. And so I will share with you a brief conversation in the car on the way to school this morning with my 13-year-old. She says, okay, so there's these words that we're not supposed to be using. Why are we not supposed to say those words? Now, this is a good question. And apparently we reach a stage of development where just because I told you so is an insufficient reason. And so 13 is apparently in the prime just because I told you so, just because we say that it is a bad word, just because we say it is foul language. You should just accept that and you should just not use those words. Well, apparently there are at least some people in her range of experience who are using words that we have put on the we don't use those words list. Not that there's an actual list, because then we'd be using the words, but you get the point. So I had this conversation, and here's how I chose to approach it, good or bad. Well, I'm just letting you know, this was my approach to the why do we not use these words? Why are these words considered foul? Why are they out of bounds? Why are they against sort of the rule of faith with which we are seeking to live our lives? And so I said, look, some of these words we don't use because they don't glorify God. So this falls into This falls into a range of words that you and I would both recognize as actually being words that appear in the Bible or concepts that are actually spiritual, related to, let's say, heaven and its ancillary, which would be hell. The concept of damnation or damning someone. And so these are words, this is language that we do not use outside of those reference, because it's not glorifying to God to do so. It's not glorifying to God if I am putting myself in the position of God to use language that is damning of another person. Like, God is the only one in a position to make those kinds of declarations and statements. And I am certainly, by my vocabulary, not in a position to consign someone to such a fate. And so that's part of what's going on there. We don't use those words because it doesn't glorify God for us to do so. But then there's this whole range of other words. I don't have to tell you what they are, because you actually know what's on the foul language list. And they are words that do not edify people. So we talked about our responsibility to not only glorify God, but our responsibility to be people who edify other people, who build people up. We don't tear them down. We don't call them names that make them less than human. We don't talk about the good gift of sexuality that God has given to us to be experienced joyfully in the context of the marriage of a man and a woman. We don't use language referring to that in ways that makes that less of a gift, less beautiful, less spectacular than it actually is. So there's some words out there that don't glorify God. We don't use those in ways that are contrary to the way God has given us those words to use. We don't use words that that are not edifying to people, that tear people down. And so there you go. That was my foul language conversation on the way to school this morning. And if that's helpful for you, that's how you get God back into a conversation about words that we're not going to be using. Carmen's example from home today. All right. So on this day in 1968, this is actually the day that Martin Luther King Jr. was shot and killed at the Lorraine Motel in Memphis, Tennessee. I lift that up to you because we have come a long way since 1968 in terms of our relationships in the United States of America between people of various races. But we're also at a stage of life in our country where conversations about racial reconciliation, in my view, really need to be led more robustly by the church, by those of us who are Christians, by those of us who recognize that the kingdom of heaven is going to be a really remarkably racially diverse place. I'm going to actually skip ahead to a story that I was going to use here towards the end of the half hour. But because I'm on this particular subject here of racial reconciliation, I want to lift this up to you. There's some statistics out there. There's some research out there that's highlighted in an article on Christianity Today called Protestantism After 500 Years. And it's talking about the reality that we are just not very far from the time when the Protestant faith is going to be more heavily represented in Africa than in the rest of the world. Like, that most Protestants will actually live in Africa within our lifetime. I mean, by sometime around 2040, half of all Protestants will live in Africa. Certainly by 2050, well over half of all Protestant Christians are going to live on the continent of Africa. So Todd Johnson is writing this piece. He's actually writing this piece as a person who grew up as a Protestant in Minnesota, and so his context was exceedingly Lutheran. He has obviously a heart for Martin Luther's 95 Theses, the door of the Wittenberg Church, upon which they were nailed in October of 1517, 500 years ago this year. So he says this: although for several centuries the Protestant movement was based in Europe and then in North America, eventually it expanded out And it spread all over the world. And today there are different types of Protestant churches, including Anglican, Baptist, Brethren, Churches of Christ, Congregational. It's a very long list, all the way down to Presbyterian and Reformed, spanning the globe. And here's what he says. There are 560 million Protestants in 2017 in nearly every country around the world. So he gets those numbers from a study from the Center for Global Christianity. And then he says this. Nearly all Protestants were European in the year 1600. But by 2017, the European share of Protestantism had dropped to only 16%. By 2050, it is expected to be less than 10% of all Protestants in the world. So the Protestants in Europe will only be 10% of world Protestantism by the year 2050. Now, African Protestants were only 1.7% of all Protestants in 1900. So that's only 117 years ago, by the way, which is a really short period of time when you talk about evangelism and church planting. And at that point, it was you were talking about mostly South Africa. But in 2017, Protestant Christians in the continent of Africa represent 41% of the total worldwide. And by 2050, they're expected to be 53%. So here's the sentence. Sometime around 2040, half of all Protestant Christians will live in Africa. Now, that represents a real shift in gravity of sort of the Protestant center of things. And what used to be, you know, something that Northern Europeans in particular sort of felt like they were responsible for and stewards of. Well, I got to tell you, at this point, we're going to be talking about Nigeria and Brazil outpacing even the United States in very short order in terms of Protestant Christianity. And so if you are not in your own life, if you are not exposed to, in fellowship with, and maybe even sitting under the teaching and leadership of an African or a South American church leader in Protestantism, you're probably sitting under the old guard, not the new guard. And so when we talk about the robust growing edge of Protestant Christianity, we are talking about we're talking about people of color. We're not talking about white Anglo-Saxon Protestants. We're just not. And so when we talk about racial reconciliation and we talk about the church and Christians being on the forefront of racial reconciliation, we're also talking about those of us who are white Anglo-Saxon Protestants learning to sit at the feet of African Protestants. And so that is probably a mammoth shift in thinking for some people, but it is the shift that God is sending as he grows the Church of Jesus Christ in the world today. Okay, you know, yesterday on the program, we talked with Matt Walsh. Today or tomorrow, we're going to be talking with Rod Dreher. Both of these men are commentators on the culture shifts that are taking place not only here in the United States of America, but in Western Christianity in general, in Western nations, where, as we just discussed, Christianity is actually on the decline. And so when Christianity is on the decline in a culture, the culture shifts. And some of those culture shifts that have taken place have sidelined certainly the Christian value system and Christian morality. And you see that in lots of ways and in lots of expressions virtually everywhere you turn, right? I mean, television is not what it was in the 1950s in terms of the moral code being upheld on the screen. Let's just use that as one example. And what's happening in schools today, in public schools today, is not like what was happening in public schools in the United States of America when most teachers were Christians, most school administrators were Christians, and most students came from Christian households. It's just not the reality anymore, not what's happening in our culture today. And so when we talk about the shifts, the cultural shifts that are taking place, and when we talk about how Christians need to not only wake up to this reality that we are now living in, which you could equate to like Babylon, but we need to talk about how Christians are going to live authentically, distinctly Christian lives in a context that is very different than the 1950s and even very different than the 1980s. So what does it look like to live in exile? I mean, to live in exile is going to affect every arena of life. People who thought they could hide from the impact of a secularized America, you're just fooling yourselves. You can't hide from this. A year ago today, my guest here on the Reconnect was Russell Moore. He talked about these exact same themes in his book, which is called Onward. Walsh's book, which we talked about yesterday, is called The Unholy Trinity. Dreyer's book is called The Benedict Option. And this isn't the sales pitch for books. This is saying that, look, these Christians who actually approach the Christian faith, approach cultural commentary, approach these conversations from very different perspectives along the Christian spectrum of the church, these guys are all pointing to the same thing. They're all pointing to the same reality. Somewhere in that mix, you're going to find an approach that fits your personality. But the cultural diagnosis offered by all three of them, and actually by others, we've had Trevin Wax on the show as well. His book addresses the exact same thing. This is Our Time. The cultural diagnosis and the Christian wake-up call just being echoed all over the place. If you are missing the call, the wake-up call to the Christian church in America today, I don't know where you are sleeping, but it is deep. So Dreyer actually has a piece posted today that's on the experience of Christians in Australia. Now, our Aussie and Canadian neighbors are often sort of harbingers of what's next for America in terms of moral and cultural shifts. And so I lift this up to you. This particular article posted on the American Conservative by Rod Dreyer is entitled Outing Christian Bigots in Australia. All right, so he says here, in this space, I have mentioned the concerns of several Christian readers that they're facing pressure from their companies to declare themselves in favor of same-sex marriage or stand exposed as bigots and marginalized. Well, folks, it's now happening in Australia. And he then shares with us this story from a reader who posted back to him this information. This reader says, some of the country's biggest businesses have upped the ante on the crusade for marriage equality by asking Australians to wear a specially designed acceptance ring until same-sex marriage is legalized here. Led by accommodation provider Airbnb and supported by Qantas, ANZ, Fairfax Media, and Foxtel, the, quote, Until We Belong campaign has been billed as the most public declaration of marriage equality so far. So the initiative calls on Australians to signal their support for same-sex couples by committing to wear the ring, which was designed by designer Mark Newson. Airbnb Australia, the country manager, said the campaign would involve the distribution of hundreds of thousands of distinctive black metal rings to its hosts, to its guests, to its business partners, and to all of its key influencers. Qantas staff and cabin crew would wear them, he said, while Google Australia has also provided rings for its 1,300 staff to wear. Our goal, Mr. McDonough, our goal is to build momentum around the issue of marriage equality and spark those conversations about acceptance. Well, sparking the conversation, it has. All right, friends, so how are you going to get God back into this conversation? If your employer said, hey, we are pro same-sex marriage, and we are providing these beautifully designed Mark Newson black rings that we want you to wear as a sign of the Until We Belong campaign, until all everyone accepts same-sex marriage, and same-sex marriage is legalized for everyone, and we're distributing these rings, are you putting it on? That's the question for the Christian today. Are you putting on the ring? Are you putting on the ring that demonstrates you're allied with the cause du jour? The cause du jour being same-sex marriage. What if the cause du jour tomorrow is thruple marriage? What if the cause du jour after that is the legalization of child marriage? I mean, whatever it is that the secular culture decides is next, and big business decides to get behind, and they decide to design a shirt, design a ring, design a hat, design a tattoo, put a sign on your forehead, whatever it is, just pinch a little pinch of incense here to Caesar. Are you going to do it? That's the question for the Christian today in the business world. And that's a question that Christians in our culture are going to have to answer. And you say to yourself, oh, Yeah, Carmen, you're exaggerating things. You know, we're talking about Australia. That's halfway around the world. A lot of water between here and there. Well, there may be a lot of water between here and there, but Qantas and Google and Airbnb are global companies. So if you don't think this is coming to the shores of the United States of America, again, time to get your head out of the sand. If you are a Christian and you work in the world today, you are going to be challenged to resist being identified as an ally of the LGBTQ sexual revolution that's taking place in our country. It's going to happen. And so you have to decide in advance, what am I going to do? Am I going to bow the knee to whatever the latest cause du jour is of the sexual revolution? Or am I going to stand where I know I must stand in allegiance to Jesus Christ, even if it costs me my job? Because that's ultimately the question. Even if it costs me my job, are you going to just go along to get along? Are you just going to go along to get along is ultimately the question you're going to have to answer. Dreyer obviously answers this question in the Benedict option by challenging Christians to actually be ready to support one another economically when our Christian neighbors and Christian friends do, in fact, lose their jobs for these reasons that we have laid out. All right, I got a quick update for you on a story that we have been covering, and it's about Pastor Andrew Brunson. You will recall that Andrew Brunson is a pastor in the Evangelical Presbyterian Church. He has been a missionary in Turkey for more than 20 years. And you will also recall that last October, both he and his wife, Noreen, were arrested and charged with, quote, membership in an armed terrorist organization. Now, Noreen was released, but Pastor Brunson has been jailed since October. Now, there's no evidence of any of this. In fact, those of us who pay pretty close attention to what's happening in this case would say that if you look closely, we're probably talking about one individual, one American Christian, being held as a pawn in an international contest of wills between Turkey, who wants back a Muslim leader who lives in Pennsylvania, and they want him back because they think that he is responsible for inciting the coup, the failed coup, which took place in the middle of last year. And so Andrew Brunson is one of the people they snatched up, hoping to maybe use as a pawn in that situation, in that contest of wills between the then Obama administration and Erdogan's Turkish government. So the good news in the story today is that Rex Tillerson, who is the Secretary of State, actually took a meeting with Noreen in Ankara. And so there is hope that the current administration is certainly more interested in helping the Brunsons secure and the Evangelical Presbyterian Church secure the release of Andrew Brunson from this Turkish situation, from this imprisonment, this false imprisonment. With these false terrorist accusations against him. And so I want you to continue to be praying for Andrew Brunson, certainly be praying for Noreen, be praying for their daughter who has postponed her wedding because, you know what, she wants her daddy to walk her down the aisle. And we understand that, and our heart goes out to them. Our prayers go up for them. And if you are a person in a position to bang on the door of a U.S. senator in relationship to this, we would invite you to do that. If you have a relationship of any kind with anybody at the Turkish embassy, you know, it never hurts to just go bang on the door. I learned that from Frank Wolf. I mean, Frank Wolf would just say, you know what, have you gone and you banged on the door? I mean, have you just stood there? I mean, at some point they got to come out. Like at some point they got to go wherever it is they're going next. And you just got to be there. You just got to be there standing there. How much does that sound like the instruction in scripture that we learn from the widow who she's just pounding on the door of heaven in relationship to her prayer concerns? So I would just encourage you to be a people of prayer who just stand and bang on the door. Just bang on the door. And so I'm banging on the door of heaven for Andrew Brunson and his family and would encourage you to do the same. All right, friends, this is The Reconnect. It is a listener-supported program by people just like you. We would certainly appreciate it if you took a minute to visit us online at reconnectwithcarmen.com. You can donate there to the ministry. You can find resources that we've posted for you. All our previous programs are there. Also, an opportunity to sign up for the podcast and share today's show with someone new. Hey, if you could help us, we'd appreciate it. You can find more information at reconnectwithcarmen.com. We'll be right back.
That you are near, trust your grace can be seen in both triumph and tragedy.
Hey friends, I'm Carmen LaBurge, and this is The Reconnect, where we're putting God in his place, back where he belongs, right in the middle of every conversation. So we are talking about the things that people are talking about in the world today, and we're also talking with the people who help us to enter into the conversations of the day, not only with the mind of Christ and the spirit of Christ, but with the information that we need to be intelligent conversationalists, to actually be effective communicators, to make the case for Christ in our culture in a way that not only honors Jesus, but lines up with the facts of the matter. And so one of the people who we like to talk with, his name is George Barna, because George Barna brings us the facts of the matter, and he's been doing it for a really long time. He is the executive director of the American Culture and Faith Institute. You may know him because of the Barna Research Group, which is something that he founded in 1984, now called the Barna Group. That is something that he started, launched, sold. He now still does similar work, but he does so at a website called culturefaith.com. And so that's where we're going to send you to get the latest stuff from George Barna himself. He's the best known pollster, I think, in my lifetime. I don't really know anybody else who breaks it down in the way that George Barna does and is so faithful to help Christians understand the context of the world in which we now live. He's a New York Times bestseller. He's written more than 50 books, mostly addressing cultural trends, leadership, spiritual development, and church dynamics. You can follow him on Twitter at George_Barna. George, welcome back to the Reconnect.
Armin, always great to be with you.
Okay, so for folks who did not hear our conversation a couple of weeks ago, can you give us an overview of the worldview study that we are sort of unpacking over time, and folks can read the full thing at culturefaith.com? But tell us about the study.
Yeah, in essence, what we want to do is figure out how many people have a biblical worldview. Everybody has a worldview. The issue is, which one do people have? And so a biblical worldview is one of the many choices that people have before them. And in interviewing, thousands of people around the country, about 6,000 people for the total study that we did, what we discovered is that only 10% of adults across America have what we would estimate to be a biblical worldview. We know that because we asked them 40 questions, 20 about their beliefs, 20 about their behaviors. And those were questions that were designed to reflect an understanding of and the following of biblical principles. So when we looked at that 10%, now, of course, it varies from population group to population group. When we look at individuals who we would classify as born-again Christians, not people who call themselves that, but people who say that when they die, they know they'll go to heaven only because they've accepted Christ as their Savior, confessed their sins, and so forth. That particular group, we're looking at about only 31% who have a biblical worldview, the group that we would consider to be the backbone of the church, not doing so well. We look at different generations, and we know that people 50 and older, the two older generations in America, the boomers and the builders, on average 16% have a biblical worldview. It drops to just 7% among the baby busters, or Gen X, whatever you want to call them, 7% among those in their 30s and 40s. And then the millennials, the group that currently is, in terms of adult years, between the ages of 18 and 30, that drops down to just 4%. So there are a lot of variables to look at, but no matter how you slice it, we're not nearly where we would like to see America be.
All right, so those are some sobering numbers. And again, folks, if you want to look at what we're talking about, you can go to culturefaith.com and you can check out the worldview survey. And there are actually a series of articles in which George is unpacking this information over time, which is why we're talking with him in a series of conversations. And today's conversation focuses in on, I'll use the word correlation, and then you can tell me if I'm using it incorrectly, but the correlation between political ideology and theology. And I'm going to ask you what you found in terms of people's, where they're at politically and where they're at in terms of a biblical worldview.
Yeah, you know, there's a correlation, and you did use that correctly. Congratulations. You would have passed my class, but we find that it's not a terribly strong correlation between one's theology and one's political ideology. If we were to look, for instance, at born-again Christians, what we find is that only half of the country's born-again Christians describe themselves as fiscal conservatives, you know, economic matters. If we look at social policies, whether we're talking abortion, marriage, those types of things, again, we find that only half of born-again Christians would be considered to be social conservatives. When you put those two things together, both fiscal and social policies, you find that just 4 out of 10 of those who are conservative on both fiscal and social matters are also born-again Christians. So, but we've got some issues here in terms of people not connecting their core spiritual beliefs with what they do or believe politically. And that's really the crux of the issue here, is why is it that we compartmentalize our faith from our politics? We'll look at the world one way spiritually, but then we look at it and respond to it in a different way when it comes to politics and governance.
Well, I suppose that the simple sociological answer to that question is because culture has been telling us now for at least a generation that faith is a private matter and should be privatized and therefore compartmentalized and should not influence conversations in the public square, doesn't belong in school, doesn't belong in terms of a fully integrated approach to life. Now, I would argue as a believer that if your Christian faith isn't the operating system of your life, if it's not forming the way you think and informing the way that you go about living your life in every arena, then it's not really the Christian faith as described by Jesus and as demonstrated by the followers of Jesus in the Bible. So I'm going to argue that what you are putting your finger on the pulse of is the breakdown in our culture between the faith of the Christian actually lived in every arena of life and some weird compartmentalized, privatized version of it that secular society has told Christians they have to smush their faith into.
Yeah, I'll buy that, and I'll go maybe what could be considered a step further, or at least build on what you're saying, and that's that it comes back to this whole issue of worldview, in my estimation. Your worldview is what I think you are referring to as the operating system of a person's life. A worldview is the mental filter that we have that enables us to understand and interpret and respond to the world around us. It informs all of the decisions we make, which is why everybody has a worldview, and it's why that worldview begins to develop at about 18 months of age, when we start making critical decisions about what we want, when we want it, who we want to be with, who we don't want to be with, all those kinds of things. It starts at 18 months, and by 13 years of age, we've pretty much fully developed the worldview that we're going to carry with us for the rest of life. One of the things I like to tell church leaders is you got to get at this early with people, because the worldview that you have at the age of 13 is, in most cases, the worldview that you're going to die with. And so when we look at this issue of politics and how we interact with what the government wants to do or doesn't want to do, the boundaries that it's setting for us, the kinds of people that we elect into office, all of that is dramatically influenced by our worldview, because our worldview tells us what's important, what's right, what's meaningful, what we ought to or ought not to be doing or accepting. All of those kinds of things we make those decisions based on our worldview. And so when we look at the fact that, you know, only 3 out of 10 born-again Christians has a biblical worldview, that helps to explain why then we don't vote biblically, we don't look at issues biblically, we're not involved in politics because we don't think that our faith tells us that we need to be involved, and the other kinds of political choices we make, what campaigns we get involved in, candidates that we may support financially. All of that is all over the map, again, because we lack the consistency that a biblical worldview would give us.
All right, friends, we're talking to George Barna. You know him as a pollster. I also know him as a best-selling New York Times author. You can check out all of his research that we're talking about today at culturefaith.com. We're talking about this massive worldview investigation that you all have done. George, I want to remind people, I know we told them this on an earlier program, but I want to remind them, if folks are thinking to themselves, I wonder how I would shake out on George Barna's worldview survey here. As he's saying these things, I wonder how I would line up on these 20 indicators that he's talking about. Where can folks go to evaluate their own worldview?
Yeah, if they go to the American Culture and Faith Institute's website, which is at culturefaith.com, on that website, you'll find that we've actually put the 40 questions, the 20 belief questions, the 20 behavior questions, they're up there. When you go to the home page, on the right-hand side of the page, there's a tab that says Worldview Measurement Project. And if you click on that tab, that'll take you to another section of the website that's got a lot of the information, but it also will provide you with the different questions that you can go into and see how you do.
Well, and I think that when, you know, when parents are hearing this and grandparents are hearing this and they're thinking to themselves, wow, I have this window of time from 18 months to 13 years. I gotta get busy. One of the things that you say is that we didn't get here overnight. We didn't arrive at this reality in America overnight, where this tremendous disconnect between not only belief and behavior inside of the so-called Christian community, but in terms of the influence that Christian belief is having in the public square. So from your perspective, for those who are interested in seeing a revival of Christian influence in our culture, what's the starting point, and then what's sort of the timeline people should be thinking about?
Well, I think an important part of that conversation has to do with who has the influence, or what has the influence on the development of our worldview and how we see, understand, respond to the world. And what our research has shown is that the three dominant influences are parents, media, and government. Government, because it creates laws that give us cues about what's considered legal. Now, a lot of people say, oh, that's stupid. I mean, you can't legislate morality or that type of thing. But the reality is that's all that the law is. The law is there to tell us what's right or wrong. We may label it legal or illegal, but essentially it's what's right or wrong. And that's important because we know that if you do things that are wrong according to the law, you'll be penalized, you'll be punished. And so, yes, even as young people, we begin to take our cues from what the law says is good or moral or legal or what isn't. So government matters. So we've got to think carefully about who are we putting into office? What do they believe? Because you do what you believe. And so if we elect somebody, we know they have beliefs just like we do. It's important for us to get to know those beliefs because they will create laws that are consistent with their beliefs. We've got to look at the media because we know that it's sending us messages constantly. We spend hours after hour ingesting messages from the media. But those messages don't all point us in the right direction. We know that by the time a high school student graduates from high school, he or she will spend an average of about 16,000 hours having been exposed to different messages from media. And when you compare that to how much time they spend with messages they get from religious sources, churches, religious TV, etc., it's less than 1,000 hours, way less than 1,000 hours. So we've got to be very careful about the kind of media that we're allowing children and young adults to be exposed to. You know, we've got to monitor it. We've got to mediate it, which means that after we monitor it, we know what they're seeing. Mediate it, that is, we discuss it with them so that there's clarity about the kinds of messages they've got. And we may want to minimize it. That is, not simply give them a blank check and say, spend as much time with the media as you want, because that's generally not in a person's best interest. And maybe the most important group are parents. Parents have an intimate understanding of what their kids are doing, or at least they should. And they have an incredible opportunity to shape the thinking and the relationships and the behaviors and the choices that their kids are making. Now, the challenge here is that as a parent, you can't give what you don't have. And we know that most parents do not have a biblical worldview. Most born-again parents don't have a biblical worldview. And so that says that a lot of the older people like me, people who are grandparents now, we may have to become part of that parenting process to make sure that younger kids are getting the kinds of conversations and dialogue and boundaries that they need so that they can be making wiser choices.
So are we announcing today that we can all send our kids to Barna Camp this summer? Just kidding. I'll just send mine. It'll be great. All right. So we're talking to George Barna. He is the executive director of the American Culture and Faith Institute. You can find out what we're talking about today and get your own worldview measured via the Worldview Measurement Project on a website called culturefaith.com. You can also reach out to George Barna directly on Twitter. He's at George_Barna. And we loved having you here today. We look forward to this continuing conversation. This is an essential part of helping to equip our listeners to take the next step in their faith. Part of it may be them coming to the place where they recognize they are among that percentage of people who you have just identified, parents who maybe don't feel like they have in their wheelhouse what they need in order to give the next generation. But maybe there's also people listening who are in that grandparent age of life and maybe not in the grandparent stage of life. And I want to be the person who invites you into the life of the kids in your congregation, the kids in your neighborhood. Any kid that God puts in your sphere of influence is a kid that you could be influencing in this particular way. You could help them understand that God is good and God is present and God is interested in them, and that God's design for life is good and beautiful and true. And if we can get them, moving in that direction, then we can start talking about cultural transformation a generation or two generations from now. Hey, George, thank you again so much for joining us on the Reconnect.
Harmon, it's always great to be with you.
Thanks. All right, friends, it's the time in the show where we like to go below the fold, the point where we lift up a story and try to make connections for you that are designed to help you start and engage in conversations that may not otherwise appear to be about God, but where the introduction of eternal principles is actually going to help you maybe not only change the conversation, but begin to introduce into somebody's worldview a different way of thinking about things. It's unusual for a person's worldview to change, but you and I also know that without the introduction of the world-changing gospel, somebody's worldview is never going to change. And this is a battle for hearts and minds, and it's a battle for the hearts and minds of every single person that you're going to engage every single day. So I'm going to bring you right now an article that when I ran across it on Twitter, the tweet quoted this: "The world is better than ever." That was the tweet that caught my eye. That was the clickbait for me. I thought, if the world is better than ever, I need to click on that because there is some sort of Genesis 1 and 2 hook. There has to be. And instead, where I arrived was something that is produced by Our World in Data, which frankly is a very progressive view of humanity and a progressive view of the world. And so I thought, what better story to lift up to you today than, frankly, a story that is just utterly ridiculous. So here we go. The world has 100 people glimpsed over 200 years of history. Now, I have no idea why that's the lead, but it says the global outlook may be brighter than we think. And then it shows all of these charts. Now, this is a Reuters story posted by Gus Lubin, who's a senior correspondent for Reuters Business Insider. So the article basically talks about how we have come a long way, how the world is progressing. And then we get this. It's hard to think of anything that pessimists could hold up to counter these positive trends. Here are the positive trends. Extreme poverty has collapsed, they say, over the last 50 years. Basic education and literacy have exploded. Democracy has rapidly spread throughout the globe. Vaccination against some of the worst killers of human history has become almost universal. Child mortality has collapsed. And then this sentence: it's hard to think of anything that pessimists could hold up to counter these trends. So I'll just say, you know, I'm not a pessimist, I'm just a realist. So I don't actually know what the pessimists would hold up to counter these trends. But in just today's news, I'm going to hold up the mudslide in Colombia. I'm going to hold up the terrorist attacks yesterday in Russia. I am going to hold up the gassing of citizens by their own government in Syria. I'm going to hold up the issue of rampant global sex trafficking. I'm going to hold up the selling of female girls into forced marriage. I'm going to hold up the whole situation with ISIS and global Islamic terrorism. I don't know about you. I'm not even a pessimist. As a realist, it doesn't take me very long to come up with what they would say is evidence that counters these trends. Now, when we talk about sheer numbers of people living in abject poverty around the globe, have things gotten better in the past 50 years? Have things gotten fundamentally better? Yes, but is it better than it's ever been? No, it is not better than it's ever been. And so here's what they credit the better than it's ever been progress to. It says, progress will continue because mankind is in a better position than ever to deal with the problems. We have a much stronger group than ever on this planet, by the way. These would be the Davos globalists, if you're looking for who they're talking about. This group of people who is smarter than any group that's ever been on the planet and more progressive and therefore, in a better position to solve the big problems through collaborative thinking and collaborative undertakings, basically, they're saying that the progressive, that progress in the world can progress unabated as long as these globalists who are all, by the way, progressive in their worldview, as long as they're allowed to set the agenda and move the conversation forward around the world. I use the term worldview because you have to listen to some of the language that is used in the article. Roser, who is the person behind the study, Roser is the person who is making these arguments that the world can not only is the world better than it's ever been, it's going to continue to get better than it even is now, as long as these globalists are allowed to be the ones that set the agenda and move things forward. He says this: the story that we tell ourselves about our history and our time matters. He's talking there about worldview. He says, knowing that we have come a long way in improving living conditions and the notion that our work is worthwhile to all of us, it is a necessary condition for self-improvement. And then he goes on to say, freedom is impossible without faith in people. If we are not aware of our history and falsely believe the opposite of what is true, we risk losing faith in each other. I got to tell you, the whole concept of faith in each other is what got us here. The world was once better than it is now and better than it ever will be under human stewardship and management. And that is the good old days all the way back in Genesis 1 and 2. So if you want to see evidence of how things were supposed to work and how we are supposed to manage it, I need you to turn there and put your faith in the God who made it all. All right, friends, this is The Reconnect. We're completely out of time. I'll see you right back here tomorrow. Have a great day and God bless.
The Reconnect is brought to you by the Presbyterian Lay Committee. To continue the conversation and become part of the Reconnect community, visit reconnectwithcarmen.com.